you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that works 50% better after you fix a typo in our INI file. It's July 19th, 2018, and we're here to help you through your summer doldrums the only way we know how. This week we cover a bunch of topics from TV shows we're watching, to Jason's maiden voyage as a D&D dungeon master, to Octopath Traveler, and some thoughts on JRPGs and storytelling. Then we have a belated discussion about Guild Wars developer ArenaNet's decision to fire two of their writers over some tweets, before closing out with some talk of Nathan Fillion's breezy Uncharted fan film and an entertaining typo someone found in Aliens Colonial Marines. The typos mostly come at night. Mostly. Let's go. Welcome back once more to Kotaku's Split Screen. We're so glad that you're here with us. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I am the editor-at-large for Kotaku.com, back from vacation and very glad to be podcasting again. We are joined, as always, by the Cyrus to my Tressa, Mr. Jason Schreier, news editor at Kotaku. Hello, Jason. How's it going?
Hello, Kirk. Welcome back to the show. It is good to have you returning.
It's nice to be back, though. I have to say, you did a very good job in my absence. I think the show sounded great. I enjoyed the Batman impersonator that you had on to talk about Octopath Traveler last week. I thought that was a nice little thing.
Yes, Tim Rogers did an excellent job, and then Nathan Fillion came on earlier this week, and everyone should listen to that. I even asked him about Inara and Mal just for you.
I appreciated that.
And he said that yes, they do get together.
It's nice when people just sort of confirm that sort of thing for you.
Mm-hmm. So good job. So your everyone's kind of like romantic pipe dream came true, even though, as I told Nathan Fillion, if that was actually like, if there was actually a second season of Firefly, they would get together and then Joss Whedon would immediately kill one of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, they would get together and then it would turn out that Inara is evil and Mal has to kill her or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Inara would be possessed by a demon. So anyway, Kirk, we're going to talk about a lot of things today. First of all, what have you been up to over the past couple of weeks? Anything interesting that you want to share?
I've been on vacation. I've done so many things. I have one thing in particular that I wanted to share that I just watched last night, and it was the first episode of a BBC show called Killing Eve that I bet a lot of our listeners have maybe heard about. It stars Sandra Oh, and she was just nominated for an Emmy. Apparently the first Asian, at least woman, or maybe ever, to be nominated for an Emmy, which is ridiculous. Wow. But anyways, she got nominated for that. I saw people talking about it. I've heard people just sort of singing this show's praises, and I finally heard what it's about, which made me decide to watch it. So we watched the first episode last night, and it's fantastic. The first episode was great, and knowing that people say it's good makes me excited to watch the rest of it. Just to give a brief synopsis for anyone interested, it's a show about Sandra Oh, who people might know from Grey's Anatomy, a really cool actress. I've always sort of liked her. She plays an MI5, I think maybe now MI6, agent who is sort of an analyst who's tracking down this Russian assassin, who's another woman who's this kind of a true psychopath, but a very interesting character. And it sort of tells the story of the two of them. I gather it's sort of this cat and mouse story as they grow infatuated with one another. And it's just really great. I
sort of the Mr. and Mrs. Smith of TV shows.
I guess. It's hard to say what it's like. There's a part in the middle of the first episode that is straight up a Hitman level. And it's amazing. I felt like I was watching someone play through Hitman. It's got costumes. Nice. It's got a party in Italy. It's got
like in a Marrakesh
and like a sort of custom killing and everything. And I liked that. It's definitely,
you should write about that for Kotaku.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Well, I'll watch the rest of the show. Anyways, I just wanted to say that I liked it, and I liked the first episode, and I'm psyched to watch the rest. It's on BBC, so cool. You have to watch it through BBC America. I think if you have like, we have Comcast, so it's there, and I think it's going to be on Hulu at some point this year. And I have a feeling that when
I thought you didn't have cable.
Oh yeah, no, we have cable.
For some reason I thought you were a cord cutter.
No, I didn't used to have cable, but Emily and I have it. Because at this point it's free.
Oh, I guess you moved in with Emily.
Yeah, and I mean, you can get it for almost free, basically, when you get internet, if you get it through a cable provider. But I have a feeling that when it's on Hulu, a lot more people are going to be able to watch it and talk about it, because it's good, man. I really recommend it.
Cool. Amanda and I were, the other day, we were looking for a new show to start, and so we were flipping around. Amanda was like, how about that show Wild Wild Country? And I was like, oh, Kirk has been telling me on the podcast that I should check that out. And we almost watched that, but then I was like, I kind of want to start Mad Men, because I gave it a little shot a long time ago. Oops. And phone ringing.
It's a very professional podcast.
Did not set it to vibrate. Classy podcasting. I kind of wanted to start watching. Oh, that's probably my dermatologist. I should really pick that up. Do you guys want to hear? Should I pick up my dermatologist phone call in the middle of recording the podcast?
Oh, so you say it's going to spread and I need to put the ointment where?
Actually, I'm waiting for the results of like this little biopsy that they took from like this thing on my shoulder. So maybe that's it. And you could all hear me just be horrified.
Now everybody's going to be worried about you.
No, it's fine. And actually, I just took a break from recording to pick up the phone, and it turns out it's benign, so really nothing to worry about.
That's great. I'm glad that everybody got to be here to share this moment with you.
Yeah, you guys got to enjoy that. So anyway, we started watching the first 2 episodes of Mad Men. I thought it's pretty interesting, but I'm going to keep watching, and I'll keep updating folks on my thoughts. But the funniest thing was Amanda and I were talking about it, and she was like, man, it's like this is basically nothing has changed as far as sexism in the workplace and all the horrible stuff that they spotlight. And it feels like that's what one of the points that the show is trying to make, is that even though this is a period piece set in the 50s, it's supposed to like be a reflection of modern day culture, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a lot of things. That show is a lot of things. It's interesting to imagine watching it now after it's sort of marinated in the cultural consciousness for so long. There's been so much written about it, books and think pieces and essays, and the show itself went through so many transformations and evolutions. I watched almost all of it. I sort of fell off near the end. Someday, I always tell myself the lie that someday I'll go and watch the ending, because I don't actually really know how it ends. It's fascinating, man. I think you'll dig it. It's like it's a slower burn than.
So you just watched all the way up until the last season and then
something
stopped?
Like that. No, like not the last season, but maybe the second to last. It was sort of like you know, sometimes you just fall off of shows, and that one, it's a pretty slow burn, and it kind of becomes pretty circular and very, it's a character study. It's almost like a still life. I don't remember which critic, somebody described it that way once, that the show almost feels like a still life. Like it's almost this meditation on life and identity. And then it, like on the surface level, there's a lot of stuff of just sort of, analysis of sexism in the workplace and the changing times and the rise of feminism in the 60s. But it also, you know, it's just this weird, I mean, you'll see the more you watch it, it's really about these characters, and Peggy and Don Draper in particular are sort of investigated, and they're totally taken apart and put back together multiple times. I mean, Don Draper is a really complicated character, and it's also,
interesting.
And Matthew Weiner, the guy who created the show, worked on The Sopranos, so that there's sort of a through line
there. He submitted the pilot of Mad Men as his like audition for The Sopranos.
Right.
That's how he got the job.
And it's kind of an interesting follow-up to The Sopranos, in that it's like The Sopranos kind of introduced the whole idea of this type of prestige show, which generally revolves around like a troubled white dude who's powerful and doesn't...
the anti-hero, and is dealing, who cheats on his wife all the time.
And who's like dealing with his place in the world, and is kind of a reflection of masculinity, and has a lot to say about that, which of course Don Draper does as well, though the show is also very different from The Sopranos, because it doesn't even really wrap itself in the same kind of genre trappings as The Sopranos. Like, it doesn't have the gangster movie stuff. It's just about an ad exec. And so it's about a guy who's really good at lying. I'll be curious to know what you think. That's cool that you're watching.
Yeah, I'm going to keep watching, and I'll let you know my thoughts here on this very podcast.
Nice.
And let me tell you about another thing that I just did. So this past weekend, after much anticipation and discussion, I DM'd in Dungeons & Dragons for the first time ever, and it was a lot of fun. And let me tell you this story, because I don't think I've told you this, about how this whole thing actually started and how I got this group together.
Tell me the story.
So So a few months ago, I got a message from someone who I went to college with named Drew. And shout out to Drew, because Drew said, "Hey, I listen to Split Screen every week, and I noticed that you're interested in D&D, and if you ever want to like play a game, I'm totally down." And I was like, "Holy shit, Drew, it's good to hear from you. I haven't talked to him in years." And then it occurred to me that like I could totally find like some old college friends who I hadn't seen in a while from school and who were still in the city and would totally be interested in playing, and sent out some Facebook messages and got a group together. And almost immediately we scheduled a time because everyone was immediately interested in playing because they all like listened to the Adventure Zone or whatever. And we're like, it's D&D has just had this huge resurgence, mm-hmm. as we know. Mm-hmm. And so I put this session together and I started preparing this campaign. And on Saturday, I ran my campaign for the first time, and it was really, really interesting for many, many reasons. A lot of interesting lessons come out of DMing for the first time, and I kind of suffered from some of the pitfalls that a lot of first-time DMs make, I imagine, like railroading your players because you have a full game plan in mind and you want to make sure that they follow that path.
Right.
So like I'm already taking lessons and like trying to figure out how to do better for the next time. But it was very entertaining. It was a lot of fun.
So I want to. So first, I want to know what was the story? Like, just give me like a broad picture of sort of what was so the setting, broad, who were the characters.
So my story. So I made up a story. A lot of people recommend doing a pre-made one, mm-hmm. for your first time, but I was like, no, I want to make up. Part of the fun for me, at least, would be just coming up with stuff. So it's set in the Forgotten Realms, and the story that I came up with is that someone in like a previous group of adventurers before this campaign, sort of like Not Another D&D podcast, which is the big inspiration for me, sort of like a campaign before the campaign, just like the premise of that one. A group of adventurers killed Cyric, who is the god of lies in the Forgotten Realms canon. And as a result, everyone had peace for a while. People were super psyched. And then eventually weird things started to happen throughout the world. And that's the basic premise. And then the party members all have their own personalities and goals and stuff. And I think that it's, well, I don't want to spoil it in case Drew is listening to this. Drew, if you're listening, earmuffs for a second. Just stop listening for like the next, fast forward 30 seconds. Drew. But basically the concept is going to be that everybody around the world, a lot of people around the world are trying to become the new god of lies. And so the party is going to have to find and defeat a bunch of these people and stop this from happening. Stop like a new lie, a god of lies from emerging.
Got it.
And then I'm just taking a bunch of different things as they come. I came up with this dungeon the first session that had a bunch of different puzzles. And they actually solved a puzzle that I came up with more quickly than I thought they would. Basically, it was like this room, and there were a bunch of like Zelda style crystals and a lever, and there was a mural on the front of the room that said that was just two clouds surrounding a sun, and like parting clouds and a sun, and the orbs would all change colors between like red, orange, blue, violet, indigo. And basically the concept was you had to create a rainbow with the orbs, which I think which I expected to take a while to figure out, but they figured it out pretty quickly. And then I've just been coming up with all these crazy puzzles and ideas. And basically when you become a DM, and I've heard people say this before, but I didn't really know it firsthand until I started doing it, it just takes over your life, like every spare second of every day, or like everything I see, I just am like, oh, I should come up with a variation on that to put in my campaign. Or like every second,
it's
I'm funny. Just
it's
randomly
like a, it's
thinking
like a much
things.
More healthy version of I should tweet about that. Oh, that'd be a good Twitter joke. This is like a better outlet for that same kind of background process in your mind.
Yes, very true, man. Yes, so true. Instead of trying to decide what to make an Instagram story about, you're thinking about like ways to entertain your D&D campaign. But yeah, it was really cool. It was a lot of fun. It's a really good group of dudes, and they're all NYU actor types, so you can imagine that it would just be a whole lot of fun to play role-playing game with them. So yeah, we've been having a blast.
I have a question for you about the lore in the story that you've laid out. So
yeah,
if the god of lies is dead, is that necessarily a good thing, or does that mean that people cannot tell lies anymore and everyone tells the truth?
No, well, he's not like the god of, he hasn't like created lies. Like, gods in the Forgotten Realms lore are not like responsible.
This is like a title more?
His
title? Or?
No, it's, they're supernatural beings, and like they have a lot of superpowers, but they also die. And I think, yeah, the best way to think of them is like superpowered people.
So I guess because you describe the quest as the quest to stop the people, someone from becoming the new god of lies, but doesn't mm-hmm. that mean that the world is out of balance? Does there need to be a god of lies?
Well, that'll be one of the interesting questions that the players have to ask.
I like that.
I really hope Drew isn't listening to this episode. Drew, if you're listening to this episode, just don't tell anybody.
I feel like if you've seen...
Or maybe they'll...
If you've seen one fantasy story, you're probably already asking that question, so I don't think that's that wild.
They might learn this on Saturday. By the way, when Drew came over, Drew is like the ultimate split-screen listener. When he came over, we were chatting. I hadn't seen him in a while. He was like, oh, I just finished the first book of The Emperor's Blades. Playing Hollow Knight. Basically, he's just like listening.
That's
to
good.
All
I wonder what that's like. So. I guess that's like basically what we do. The experience of doing all of the stuff that we talk about because we talk about it
exactly.
because we do it.
So. It is. It's just everything that.
So
we
I
do.
Recommend that. That seems like a good way to be. Just because that's how I am.
But yeah, man. If anyone has been listening to this and just listening to us like discover D&D and talk about it a little bit, I highly, highly recommend it. Especially if you have a good group of people. That's what matters the most ultimately. But yeah, if it's like people that you just want to hang out with and just have a good time with, it's, you're just gonna have a good time. And like part of the really fun thing and one of the things that I want to become better at as a DM is just like encouraging all these ridiculous situations and like improvising as they go. And I found myself in the first session saying no a couple more times than I would have liked to. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to say yes more, and that's one of the things that like next session I'm going to be prepared to just be like, yeah, whatever, you can do this. I don't want to railroad you. Just ridiculous situations. At one point, Drew's character was climbing the perimeter of this fortress, and it was like an open air fortress. So there were people inside, and they hadn't noticed him, and he was trying to get around. So I said, well, it's kind of like a dilapidated fortress. So if you want to scale the walls, you'll need to pass an acrobatics check. And he failed. And so he stumbled immediately in the middle of the fortress, and everyone just discovered him instantly. Just the idea of all these ridiculous, fun things happening. You can see, the other cool thing is that you can see when you play D&D that pretty much every single video game designer ever is just trying to recreate a good D&D campaign. And you can see all the similarities. And I actually think it might make you appreciate video games more if you get into
that
D&D.
That doesn't surprise me at all. That seems like it completely would.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some video games, although I know you have a quick music recommendation.
I do. I want to keep making music recommendations. This is a song I heard that I wanted to play people that is just really good from a dude who's really good. So I heard this last week. This is from a kind of recent album. Chris Thiele is a mandolin player and singer that a lot of listeners probably know, or at least have heard him if you don't know who he is. He is one of the three members of Nickel Creek, which is a really incredible sort of bluegrass.
Nickelback Creek.
They're the opposite of Nickelback in pretty much every way. They're really, really incredible. Check them out too. But he does solo stuff too. He's also the new host of Prairie Home Companion, which is now called Live From Here. And he has taken the show in a very different direction from Garrison Keillor. It's sort of more of a music show. He is a really incredible musician. So he, plays with everybody and has a really great band. And this tune that I heard, so he's like a world-class mandolin player, totally like one of the best mandolin players anywhere. He's ridiculous and also a really great singer. And this song is, the first time I heard it, it's called Falsetto. And I'll play a little clip for people right now. 'Cause Froggy thinks his whistle is the Liberty Bell, says buddy, if you say it isn't, you can go to hell with your viva la resistance, your facts and your stupid songs and your girly falsetto, girly falsetto, falling from the highest heights and the ribbons running through your vibe of vintage bikes. 'Cause everything is going great, you should be super sad. So it's a really neat song, and the first time I heard it, I just thought, oh, it's this cool song about singing in falsetto, which, you know, falsetto is like your really high, light, gentle voice. And he has, of course, this incredible voice.
Bohemian Rhapsody voice.
Freddie Mercury is the master of falsetto. And Chris Thiele also has a beautiful falsetto and a really great mix, and he just uses his voice really well on this track. He does too. Then I listened to the lyrics. I didn't realize this is from an album called Thanks for Listening. And the whole song is about how shitty Twitter is now for artists, and how like Trump sucks, and how right wing people are always yelling at him. And then there's this, it's the lyrics are hilarious if you read them. And it's all about like people telling him like, shut up, and just like with your girly falsetto and your little ribbon mics and your music, like keep the entertainment light. And then there's an aside in the middle where he just is like, I just need to take a minute and appreciate how awesome Roger Federer is at tennis. And there's sort of a verse that's just like, Roger Federer, man, he's so good. And then he just goes back to talking about like Twitter frogs and stuff. Anyways, it's a great song. Really catchy. It's been stuck in my head for like 4 days. So I wanted to get it stuck in a few of our listeners' heads. And also, if you haven't checked out Chris Thiele, Nickel Creek, his solo stuff, his stuff with the Punch Brothers, Live From Here, if that's coming to your show. This guy is the real deal. He's incredible. Totally worth checking out. So,
cool.
There's that.
Cool. So let's talk about some video games. First of all,
let's do.
Octopath Traveler is the big game of the summer, or at least of July. Last week, Tim and I talked about it for a while. I talked about many of the things that bugged me about the game. I think people tend to get rid of a lot of the nuance in video game criticism because
you don't
I saw a lot of
what?
People think
no,
that
I've never encountered that ever in my life.
I saw a lot of people like acting as if I hate this game, which I totally don't. I mean, I played like at least 40 hours by now of it. I enjoyed it. I considered like continuing to play even after my review so I could take on the boss rush in the final dungeon. I really enjoyed it because the combat system is just so good, but it's got a lot of problems. But you've been playing it fresh, and I'm curious to hear your take.
I think it's
and
fine.
Also, if you could play some like Octopath music under this, that would be incredible because it's so good.
I could talk about the music a little bit. I'm like medium on the music still.
Really?
Even after, I really like some of it. We'll get into that later. I think the game is fine, actually.
Okay.
I'm having a fine time with it. I mean, I've played 5 hours or something. I'm only through, I think, half of the characters. I know more what to expect going in, which I think has affected my take on it because I read your review. I knew, you know, going in that there wasn't going to be the sort of narrative overlap that I was hoping for when I heard about the concept. You know, when I first heard this idea, oh, there are 8 characters. I was thinking, holy shit, this could be so cool, especially in a JRPG where you would think it would be maybe kind of easier to write more dialogue because there's not as much voice acting and you can do more with narrative because you don't have to do mo-capped cutscenes for a lot of different stuff. My imagination ran away when I first heard the concept. Now, once I knew that, oh no, actually the characters only really superficially interact, it's kind of just like 8 separate stories. With that expectation, I just kind of didn't, you know, I'm not disappointed because I know what it is. So maybe that helps, but playing it, yeah, I mean, it's fun. I think it's really amazing looking. I really love the visual style and the sort of the function that it plays, the way it feels kind of like you're looking through this little keyhole on the past.
How far are you? How many chapter ones have you played?
I said 4. So
4 of them? Okay, and you haven't done any of the chapter 2s, correct?
No, correct.
So, by the time I hit, I think I remember when I got that sinking feeling in my gut was about the 6th or 5th or 7th, like around there, of the chapter 1s. And I was just like, uh-oh, this game is just going to be the same thing over and over again, isn't it?
So, yeah, I'm not going to get that, I don't think, because I know what it
you
is.
Know. And I didn't know, yeah.
Right. And also because I just don't. I never really care about the stories in most JRPGs that I play.
Well, I'm not talking about the story. I'm talking about the structure and the idea of just like, okay, this next chapter, I'm going to go to a town, then use my path action a bit.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't bug me at all.
Like, go to a dungeon and then fight a boss.
Yeah, whatever. But, like that. So I think that that's fine to me. I mean, the fact that it's like predictable and it just follows a rhythm, I don't really care. it's developing the combat system. You know, each time I've gone to a new place, it's been harder. I've had a different party. I've been trying different strategies. And that, to me, is the best thing about the game. I think you guys, ever we've gone on at length enough about the battle system in this game is good. But it has made me realize that that's kind of what I go to these games for anyway. So I was thinking about Bravely Default, which I played a lot of until that game kind of spirals and just becomes ridiculous, whatever, toward the end, and I just stopped. And I just, you know, I like the combat system in that game too. And it's very rare, actually, the JRPG where I've been invested in the story and have gone all the way through, like, kind of really feeling like I care about that. And much more common that I'll be into the combat system, and that's sort of good. Like Final Fantasy XV for me was a game where the combat system didn't work for me, and I didn't like the story, so like I was kind of just not that into that game. Final Fantasy VII was actually a game where I liked the story and all its weirdness, because there's just this sort of this total bizarreness to the games from the actual 90s that these modern games just don't seem to have, and Octopath Traveler doesn't seem to have. Octopath just seems narratively like very, very dull to me. So I started as Tressa, who I like. She's a likable character, but geez, I mean, I've done what? Primrose and Cyrus and Ulbrich have been the four that I've done. And it's just a fucking cliche salad, man. Every single one. I mean, there's been nothing that's made me remotely. So I'm just totally just almost not even paying attention. But I am paying attention to, you know, the upgrades and the interesting class abilities and the funny things you can do. I love how Primrose can get a villager to just follow her, because I got this, I think her name is Quiet Villager, and she followed us into a dungeon. And then, you know, I'd summon her, and then suddenly just here in comes flying Quiet Villager, laying down this like unbelievable amount of arrow fire and just destroying the enemies.
Yeah, there are a lot of things you can do that just cheese the system.
Well, and that cracked me up, and I really liked it. So I like that. And like I said, I really like the visuals. It's the kind of game I'm going to go play on the hammock in the backyard pretty casually. It's fine. On the music tip, I think I'm mixed on the music. I think maybe I was expecting more because I associate it with Bravely Default. No, I don't think I'm crazy. So some of the music is great. I'm certainly not saying the music isn't good. This is sort of similar. Don't reduce my nuance the way people reduce the nuance of your review. I'm definitely not saying it's not good. There's some really lovely stuff. A couple of the tracks are great. I think when we talked about this last time, I played the music from Therion's Village, which is really cool. The main title music is great. The battle theme is pretty cool.
Alfin's theme is one of my favorites.
I really like
that pitchy sax.
There's some sax that's a little out of tune. But that kind of gets to me at the thing that... I'm partly holding it to this Bravely Default standard, which is just ridiculous. Because the first Bravely Default, that was composed by Revo. This guy is a madman. And I was going back and listening to the music from that game.
That's the game that inspired the split-screen theme song.
It is. It is among a baby bird from that. But among other things, that's also just like one of the best video game soundtracks of all time. Going back and listening to it, there's so much energy. The performers are so killer. Every player on that is like shredding their ass off. And that, you know, takes the same kind of idea that I hear in Octopath Traveler, which is sort of like a lot of the melodic ideas you've heard in JRPGs before, you know, like hard rock battle themes and penny whistle world map music and stuff.
Oh yeah.
And it does so well that it sounds really good. Octopath Traveler, a lot of the times it's good. It's like really well done, and some of it's just really lovely, but it's very rare that I'm hearing anything that's like genuinely like sticking in my head or really like blowing me away on that higher level that I was sort of hoping for, at least from this game, given that the aesthetics of the game generally are very, very good.
Yeah.
So I'm a little just, it's not me saying I don't like the music. It's just, I haven't yet found the track that's really made me think, holy shit, this is amazing. But I like it generally. I'm pretty into it, and it's helping me sort of realize. It's helping me realize what I like about JRPGs.
So a couple of thoughts. One is I agree with you about the story, and trust me, the cliches don't get any better. But one of the things that the game does really well is it has a lot of cool lore and a lot of connections between the characters that you have to just kind of really pay attention and notice. unfortunately, it requires a suspension of disbelief that is just ridiculous. Like when you get to the thief and you meet the thief, it's like, no, I only work demo, alone. Yeah. And then immediately he just joins your party. And like there's a scene later, and I won't get into heavy spoilers, but basically one of the main characters' family members is in danger. I'll just put it that way. And you, in order to like prevent that danger, you need to move on to the next chapter. But for some reason, she is willing to go with all these other characters on their journeys, and the explanation, there's no explanation for why they're all traveling together, and that to me just really bothers me. Like they don't even have one common motivation that would explain them being together, which requires this level of like, on the scale of suspension belief of disbelief, like from 1 to 10, I would say it's like closer to a 10 than it is to a 1. And like, let's say that Cloud being able to raise chocobos across the planet while the meteor is in the sky ready to fall is like a 5 on that suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, I mean, I think about Bravely Default as an example, and it's these characters who all sort of had these testy relationships with one another, but also had relationships with one another,
yeah,
and were thrown together for a common cause.
Yeah, they all had a common goal.
And that, I mean, that's an old-ass storytelling trope is, you know, a bunch of disparate characters sort of unite for a common cause and then bicker and have interesting conflicts between one another. I mean, that's really standard. This game doesn't really seem like it does that.
Yeah, I don't think... that's not what I needed. I didn't need, like, character interactions in this game, but I did need the game to at least sell me on the idea, because when I don't buy what's happening, it's really hard to get into the story.
Oh, yeah, it's just that character interactions are the way they're gonna probably do that. I mean, I don't know how you do that without character interactions.
Or you just make more of the overarching goals. Like, make it a little clearer why these people are all just, like, putting aside everything to go globetrotting around the world. Like, why the thief who has this urgent quest to like remove this shackle on him by going and getting all these stones is helping out this cleric on her like trip to go
visit temples. It's weird
temples.
That there's so much writing where they like, where if you use Cyrus's ability, there's all this extra lore for like
every
single NPC.
I was gonna say that there's a lot of really good stuff in there, a lot of funny
but
moments,
like, that stuff is so weird though. I mean, I guess it's cool and you learn funny things about people and it does add a richness to the world, but also it's odd that the world has that in it and yet doesn't have this more crucial feeling connection between the characters and coherence to the main story.
So get this. So before release, there was this guy who actually claimed on Twitter, there was a whole lot of controversy because this guy claimed on Twitter that some like journalist or aspiring journalist who writes for some fan sites claimed on Twitter that Octopath Traveler started off as a series of vignettes and then all leads together to some big payoff, and that's not true at all. It's a game that's entirely about 8 different vignettes. But what people discovered after the game came out, and I remember last week, just as the game was coming out, I was part of this early process and working with this other reviewer at a site called Twinfinite, and she discovered alongside like a bunch of other, it was kind of a crowdsourced effort, that there was a dungeon and you have to do a couple of optional side quests and you get to this end game dungeon, and the side quests are never indicated or anything. Like when I finished the game with all 8 stories, there was never any clue or indication. So the best way to actually reach this is to find the Kotaku article I wrote about how to unlock it. But anyway, long story short, you get to this end game dungeon, you need all 8 characters, you have to fight all the bosses again in a boss gauntlet. After you beat each one, you get this lore dump that's like, here is why, how this boss is connected to the overarching villain world, and you read all these connections between all the different characters, and then eventually you fight this final boss who's a god, of course, because this is a JRPG and you have to fight a god. And as part of that, not only do you have to use all 8 characters in the battle, you see all 8 characters like standing together in a row, sort of like any JRPG. But here's the thing, none of them talk, and they could have used this end game dungeon as a chance to finally have all the characters like at least say a line or something all together, but nope, nothing like that happens. The characters are all mutes,
and a lot of the art for this game, I don't know, like this is not a huge complaint for me or anything, but it's just, it strikes me as strange because a lot of the art for this game shows these characters sitting around in a tavern together, and it makes me think of, like, you know, the best part in Dragon Age Inquisition is the card game, right? Uh-huh. Where like everyone gets together and there's this amazing moment where I won't go into the details because whatever, but it's really great because it shows you everyone and it makes you kind of reflect on the journey you've been on. And Octopath Traveler was really like, seemed like this beautiful art and these yep. interesting kind of fun little character tropes. You know, each one is sort of an archetype and they're all hanging out. The cover art is them all walking down the street together. And then, right, you never even see them all together, let alone see them interact.
It's just the only time you see them all together is in this endgame dungeon, but they don't say yeah. a word. You just see them all standing side by side and they don't say yeah. a word.
It's a strange game. It's strange.
It is a strange game.
But it's fun. It is fun. It's fun to play.
Yeah, it reminds me of a Saga game more than anything. Saga games are generally like stories, especially Saga Frontier is the big one where it's a story of just like seven different stories. But that just handled it so much better. There's a lot of whiplash when you're bouncing between all the chapters. And I do think I gotta like think about this and think about the nature of reviewing a game like this and playing it all in such a compressed time period and how that affects yeah. the way that you view the repetition of the game. But really, I also think that a lot of the initial people who are enamored of the game are enamored of it because they haven't played enough yet to see how really repetitive and grindy it can get. And I think that only hits you way later in the game. Like after you've played 20 hours or so, you're like, man, this is really repetitive. And that to me was the big mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess I've had that response with so many JRPGs that happens to me with almost like just so many.
Most JRPGs are good at masking it. Look at Persona 5, right? That's a game that clearly should have been shorter, should have been less repetitive, but because it's told in this vertical way as opposed to a horizontal way, because it has this overarching story, because it has these characters you really get emotionally invested in and care about, I think that you can look past a lot of the repetition. It doesn't feel like you're going to hit, like when you get to the next dungeon in Persona 5, it doesn't feel like, okay, this is chapter 7 out of 32 and
no,
off
but it
to the
does.
Next checklist.
I mean, so my point is, even when they do disguise it, it still happens that way with JRPGs a lot of the time. Like I still start to feel like they're repetitive. So this one also feels that way, but
I'm emotionally invested, I can look past that. I guess
I don't get emotionally invested in very many JRPG stories. And of course, I mean, I finished Persona 5, like partly because I was reviewing it, but I would have finished it anyways. I finished Persona 4. I wasn't reviewing that. Like, yeah, those games have good stories. Persona 4 had a great story.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it does kind of draw you through all the repetition. And you want to kind of repeat stuff and grind because you want to get more powerful and see more of the game. I was right. actually talking to someone about Hollow Knight related to this, compared to sort of games like Enter the Gungeon or Binding of Isaac, and how, you know, how Hollow Knight is... because it's so authored and the whole game, it's not procedurally generated at all. The thing that motivated me through the hardest stuff in that game was wanting to see what was next, like wanting to see what else I would find and keeping going so that I could make more discoveries. And like if just base repetition and sort of gradually increasing your stats is rarely enough to keep me going. So in that mm-hmm. case, I agree.
So we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will talk about ArenaNet and maybe some other video game related topics.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life one week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Kirk, when you were on vacation, you missed out on some serious video game drama that we have not yet had a chance to talk about. This all actually unfolded a couple of weeks ago, so we're pretty late to this party, but this is an interesting and kind of nuanced enough topic that I think we would be remiss not to talk about it. So let's talk about ArenaNet and what happened there. So first, some context here. So ArenaNet is the developer behind Guild Wars 2. Jessica Price is the name of a narrative designer, a former narrative designer now at ArenaNet, and she was working on the story for the game. She was a writer on the game. She is also very active on Twitter and has developed something of a reputation over the months and over the years for being combative on Twitter. So on July 4th, someone named Doror Gaming responded to one of her Twitter threads about writing in an MMORPG, saying he wanted to politely disagree and talking about some stuff with like offering a suggestion for her. She responded saying, "Today in being a female game dev, quote, allow me, a person who does not work with you, explain to you how to do your job." And then she said, "Like the next rando asshead who attempts to explain the concept of branching dialogue to me, as if, you know, having worked in game narrative for a fucking decade, I have never heard of it, is getting insta-blocked. PSA." And then there was a whole huge uproar in the Guild Wars 2 community. It, of course, overlapped in Gamergate circles, and Gamergate terrible people at Gamergate started amplifying this, and people started calling for her to get fired. It became a whole mob, outraged mob. And then the next day, ArenaNet put out a statement, or maybe it was that night. At some point in this whole thing, ArenaNet put out a statement from Mike O'Brien, the CEO over there, who said, "We have fired her," and another writer, Peter Fries, who had also just happened to defend her on Twitter. Then it became a huge kind of controversial, like a tipping point in a lot of ways, and a lot of people came down strongly in many different forms. A lot of game developers spoke out against this, saying that ArenaNet had kowtowed to an angry mob. A lot of gamers and Guild Wars 2 hardcore fans appeared to be happy with the move and made it seem like it was ArenaNet kind of saying that fans won and placating them in a good way. People were supportive in that way. And some people have claimed that Doror Gaming was like a sponsored Guild Wars 2 YouTuber. So he was, I guess, involved in that community pretty heavily. And yeah, a lot of fallout from that in some really complicated ways. So Kirk, first let me ask, what is your take on this whole situation?
Oh, I mean, I have a lot of takes. I think there's a lot of takeaways from this. It's a mess, obviously.
What are your takeaways?
I will list them. I think a lot of things. I think ArenaNet should not have fired both of these employees. I think that was just the wrong call. I think that ArenaNet also, O'Brien's statement saying that this was an attack on the community and just letting that stand sort of escalated. I saw a lot of people pointing out that they could have said, you know, we've let people go over whatever, you know, the usual vague statement that you get. And they didn't do that. In fact, they described specifically this as like an attack on the community, which to me feels like an overstatement, a dramatic overstatement of what happened. So I think that was the wrong call. I think that this, yeah, my sense of this interaction, which is like a much dicier thing to try to parse. But I think, you know, based on interviews with Price after this happened, it seems to me like this was kind of a straw that broke the camel's back thing. I, of course, am very aware of what it is to be a woman online, you know, not personally, but I've listened to enough stories at this point that I know how it goes. And especially being a woman in development or in tech or in game design, you're constantly having guys sort of do this, you know, various levels of rudeness and politeness kind of coming to you and saying,
having to prove yourself.
Yeah, and like, and just saying to you, hey, I like know how to do your job. Let me tell you this, you know, the sort of mansplaining thing. Mm-hmm. In this case, you know, reading this response, this guy Doror, I mean, it's tough because his tweet to her is, and he starts, he's like, very interesting thread to read. However, allow me to disagree slightly. He's very polite. I mean, it is a polite tweet to her. It's just he's not aware of the context in which it's coming. Clearly, it set her off, you know, and that. I can totally see how this could happen. I think right. there have been a lot of people being like, she was horrible to him. Like, she called him a random asshat, or at least referred to his type of person as a random asshat when he was actually very polite. And that sets this whole thing off on a really shitty beginning, because mm-hmm. it's easy to just say, oh, well, this was justified and she was horrible to this very polite man. You know, when of course there is this broader context, and I'm sure she has to deal with people being jerks all the time. And it's totally understandable that you would, you know, respond very, maybe overly negatively to someone who is being polite because you've been getting shit all day. I think, you know, everyone has done that at some point, right? Like, you snap at somebody who says something because you're mad about somebody else.
Of course, because it's whatever. Like the straw that broke the camel's back. Yeah.
So I think that in that respect, this, it makes the whole thing feel more complicated than this. It makes it, it's just not as symbol of a question in this specific case.
Yeah, I'll let you finish in a second, but just one more wrinkle that's worth bringing up is that Jessica Price said in follow-up interviews afterwards that she had never been warned about her social media presence before, and in fact that she had talked to them about it when she was being interviewed and was kind of like, I'm pretty loud and an advocate of a lot of topics on social media, and according to Price, ArenaNet was fine with that.
Right, so that gets into ArenaNet's response to this, which to me just seems to me totally out of line, or at least totally, I mean, unless there's shit that we don't know. I mean, they haven't really commented beyond that one statement, but that statement is crazy.
Well, so yeah, they had two different statements. One was like shorter, like we just have dismissed the two employees, and then there was one longer one that they sent to Polygon that was this long thing. I won't read the whole thing, but basically it was just blaming Jessica and... Jessica Price and Peter Fries for not engaging respectfully and professionally to their customer.
So, okay, so this, what happened was, to me at least, a case of something that should have been dealt with internally, did not strike mm-hmm. me as a fireable offense.
That's the biggest thing. It's like people don't even realize on the internet that there is a long, like a spectrum on the punishment scale from not being punished at all to getting fired. And it's like if I said something on Twitter that was shitty, Steven would probably call me up and be like, what the fuck, man? Let's talk about this and maybe even reprimand me in some way. But like... firing is pretty much the most drastic action you could take.
Well, and I mean, I understand why people go for it immediately, because it's the thing you can see, and you don't want to hear, mm-hmm. oh yeah, we had a talk with this yeah, person. You want to be course. Like, I saw justice or whatever.
Right. And that's that's why it's yeah, a whole lot of people said, and I agree that it was kowtowing to mob justice, because it's like, yes, this, I think it's fair to say that, yes, Jessica Price, whether she was warranted or not, she was being an asshole to this guy who didn't seem to deserve like the way that he was spoken to by her. Yes, I think I can agree with that.
I wouldn't say she was being an asshole. I would say she was responding maybe overly harshly to.
Yeah,
to
I mean, that's being calling him an asshat is being an asshole. Like that's
okay, sure.
Being rude to one of their fans. Yes, that is objectively true. I think she was rude. She was not nice to this guy. But like, if ArenaNet has a problem with that, they should have dealt with it internally, right. And certainly as soon as it started becoming a whole Gamergate thing and clearly this angry mob out for blood, then they should have realized and recognized, hey, if we do this, like, we are sending a signal to all of the people, especially the women who work for ArenaNet, that we are not going to stand up for them, that we do not have their backs. And that to me is the biggest problem here.
And that, I mean, that Peter Fries was fired. I mean, and if you back up one of your employees on Twitter, you're going to get fired too. I mean, what the fuck? Like, that's really weird. So, okay. So I think, I mean, that's fair. I mean, it's not a clear cut situation, but I feel pretty clear about all of that. What this opens to me is some of the things they said have made me think a lot about how people interact with Twitter and some kind of like fucked up things that Twitter has successfully engineered into the way that we behave on this space. So Matthew Burns, friend of the pod and, you know, game developer, composer, cool guy, tweeted something about to this extent as this was sort of happening, that Twitter has basically fooled everybody into thinking that it's a private, that you're working in a personal space mm-hmm. when you're not. Mm-hmm. And that it basically, it foments engagement by having conflict like this, by tricking people into saying things that they wouldn't otherwise say in public. And I think there were a lot of telling quotes about that when people were talking about this. I think Price at one point refers to Twitter as, you're coming into my space, which I understand feeling that way about your Twitter, even though your Twitter isn't entirely your space. I think that maybe Fries called it her private Twitter in a quote, and it's not a private Twitter. You can have a private Twitter account or you can be in a private community, but it's not, right? It's public. And this is something that, you know, we have wrestled with as an outlet in 100 different ways, how to quote people on Twitter, whether people were intending something for public consumption, despite mm-hmm. the fact that on Twitter it is for public consumption. And then there's the role of what somebody who works for a company, how they are supposed to comport themselves on a platform that is both personal, feels private, isn't private, is open to anyone to read and to interact with you, and is actually kind of designed to encourage this kind of thing, where you feel like, this is just my place. Twitter is like, I got my followers. I'm looking at my feed. I just see my curated thing. I'm sort of sounding off about whatever I want. I'm talking about whatever I want. I think everyone who uses Twitter kind of feels that way. And yet Twitter repeatedly punctures that over and over again through its design, because anything can escalate. Anything can become public. Anything can turn into a huge flashpoint the way that this did, the way that plenty of other things have over the years. And it's a kind of a, it's almost like, I would say it's a flaw of Twitter, except that at this point it's very clear that it's not a bug, it's a feature, right? Mm-hmm. It's the way they designed the platform to operate. It's supposed
to
be doing this.
Right, to amplify anybody.
Yeah, this is Twitter operating as usual, and it's like ruining careers and ruining lives, and the whole thing has made me feel very aware of the twisted way that Twitter has successfully made us view it as a platform, and mm-hmm. many of the built-in problems that Twitter has.
I think. Yeah, Ben, what just really, I mean, yes, but it's, you can't blame Twitter for this. I mean, you can't blame Twitter for like ArenaNet just throwing their employee under the bus in the worst possible way.
Yeah, it's not as simple as saying I blame Twitter, but I think that that's not what I'm saying. I don't say I blame Twitter. This is Twitter's
right.
fault.
I'm saying
this completely yet again illuminates this built-in aspect of Twitter that is, I think, very problematic, like very just ripe for all kinds of bad shit.
Yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying. But I do think that it's worth, like, I've gotten a lot of people on Twitter who have been tweeting at me when I've talked about this stuff on Twitter, saying like, Jason, like, I respect you, but you're totally wrong here. Like, Jessica Price was targeting the community. She was harassing the community. She was bringing up sexism for no reason. Like, people basically defending what ArenaNet did here. And to those people, I say, like, just looking at this as this black and white situation where either you're fired or you're not, is just such a like terrible reductive way of looking at the situation, and like nobody should be fired for tweeting like anything. When should I can't envision a situation unless someone is like straight up like going full Gamergate or like harassing people online, or like even then it's like talk to someone first. Like the fact that you would just give in to this angry mob, this angry throng of social media users and Reddit users, and throw your employee to the wolves just says so much about how you operate as a company and how you just have no respect for the people who work for you and no interest in protecting them. Because the fact that they would just like, man, if someone's being an asshole on Twitter, then go talk to them, go pull them into your office and say, hey, you can't do this. This is your final warning. If you do this again, you will be fired. But they did not do that. They just gave her up. They threw her to the wolves. And that, to me, no matter how much of an asshole she was being, that, to me, is just not okay.
So to zoom this out a little bit, I think this is kind of an interesting aspect, a new challenge for this world of service gaming and of just community, you know, engaged communities in general. It almost goes beyond gaming. It's this new world where there are people who make entertainment products and content, and they want to engage a fan base. Everything, you know, you want to have fans engaged. You want to have these maximum hours of eyeballs viewing your stuff. And that means you need to court and maintain a community, which is something, you know, obviously that games have been experimenting with for a long time and are kind of out front on. The whole idea of a community manager, at least to me, has always struck me as a video game invention that has now spread to everywhere. I'm sure there's like 25 community managers working on Marvel for Disney and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And there's this question of, you know, who is more important in this new world? You know, is your audience more important than your talent? And how do you prioritize that as a company? And I think we're seeing a lot of companies wrestle with that, understandably to an extent, even though I think, obviously, we both think in this case, ArenaNet did the wrong thing, kind of wrestling with, well, we have to maintain keep the community happy. And if we don't, you know, we do so at our peril. Destiny is a very good example of this, because watching, it's been fascinating and a little disorienting to watch Bungie's hardcore about face. They're like, they've like prostrated themselves in front of the community over the last 6 months. It's a little bit, you know, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to overstate it, but it's watching this developer that used to be this kind of confident, whatever, we make Halo, we share some thoughts behind how we made it, but we just make awesome shit, turning into this, tell us what we did wrong, please, like, love us kind of situation, and making the game almost, you know, to demand by their audience. It reflects to me, it's a very extreme version, but it reflects to me a general trend in the games industry. I guess I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that, on just the shifting relationship between the creators and the audience as the audiences become more important and need to be kind of groomed and maintained.
Yeah, I mean, you see that with everything. You saw it with Battlefront 2. You see the industry just changing their loot boxes, as we've talked about in the past, as a result of that. You saw it with, I think, the kind of big linchpin for this whole thing was the Xbox One. And the just horrible reactions to that. And actually, if you look back even further to the Xbox One rumors, and you look at what happened with Adam Orth, do you remember that, when he was fired for tweeting about how customers without internet, without high-end internet connection should just deal with it? That was kind of a prototypical example of this whole thing, where someone just provokes the ire of the Twitter mob and is punished for it. And oftentimes the things they're saying are just not that bad, or if they are bad, they're certainly not worth being fired over. And it's just like, once you are, it's just all PR. And it's sort of, I mean, it's just a different scale of the same sort of PR questions that big companies have been dealing with for years and years and years. It's just way easier for any employee to make a PR flub now, because it's so easy to discover them and amplify them and talk about them in ways that we couldn't before. But yeah, as far as just like the idea of this push-pull between developers and community, that's something that I think was around to a way smaller extent with the rise of early MMOs and text-based MUDs even. Because those were all just based on community development and that sort of thing. Ultima Online, there are all sorts of stories about the early days of the community and what kind of things they did and how the developers interacted with them. There's this famous story of Ultima Online players killing Richard Garriott's character, Lord British, even though he was supposed to not be able to be killed. So yeah, it's been around for a while. It's kind of been amplifying more and more as more games become that kind of service game. So it's definitely, we're going to see more cases like this. And I really think that it needs to be, I think two things need to happen now. I think one is that every single game company needs to make it clear, like, here is what your social media policies are. Here is what you should do if you are being harassed by a mob of people. And here is what we are going to do to protect our employees. Like, they just need to make everything a lot clearer. clearer. And the second thing that I think needs to happen is that game developers need to unionize stat ASAP and just have something to fight with, like have more leverage than just like being under control of your company and just letting them do whatever they want for whatever reason. Not that a company shouldn't be able to fire it, its employees, because it certainly should have a control over who works for it, but just being able to protect yourselves in any sort of way, I think is really important.
Agree.
All right, so we have a list of other things to talk about, but we are almost out of time. So why don't we just hit one more thing real quick, and then we'll say goodbye. You want to talk about the typo?
Oh yeah, I thought this story was very funny. So this is
okay,
the story,
give us a story
of so in Aliens Colonial Marines, not a good game,
not a good video game.
Came out a few years ago, released by Gearbox. One of the kind of now quintessential versions of this game was shown to be one thing, and then we played it, and it was really bad. And like, what the fuck? It kind of actually ruined.
Released by Gearbox, but mostly developed by TimeGate, as revealed in a story that we published back then about the game.
Though I will say that in the wake of that game, I think that that game more than anything else really tarnished Gearbox's reputation among players. I think probably because Randy Pitchford came out and introduced the game and is sort of associated with this version of the game that then never existed. And so famously bad, really terrible. And apparently it turns out there's a typo in the INI file. And if you fix it, the AI of the aliens is improved significantly. Like, it doesn't make it a good game. And Cameron Kunzelman wrote about this over the weekend. He tried it out and kind of had some video of the two different ways the aliens act. But it did actually improve the way that the aliens attack. They didn't just kind of walk at you straight. There was this really famous clip of the alien walking on its hind legs. Looking like as ridiculous as like a Labrador up on its hind legs, kind of pretending to be a person. And it does kind of make them not do that. And they jump and they kind of dodge. So this is a hilarious story and a ridiculous one, that this typo would last for this long, that nobody would have found it, that I don't know, like that no one noticed that the aliens weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. Like, it kind of boggles my mind that it stayed in the game. I mean, how the fuck does this happen? How did that happen?
Well, I think that question. AI is so complicated and bugs can be coming from so many different sources that like a typo in code. I mean, yeah, it's every engineer's like worst nightmare is just some typo.
But wouldn't
that sticks
you think
there.
If you released a game and you had designed the game to do certain things and it just straight up was not doing a noticeable number of those things and everyone was being like, why does this suck? It's not this is garbage, that you would say, I'm going to figure out what it is. I mean, I'm obviously,
well,
it's
there
harder
are a lot
to
of
figure
possibilities
it out.
Here. Okay. A lot of possibilities. One is that people thought that it was just so buggy that it could have been caused by any number of things and it wasn't even worth looking
sign.
Into. Two is that the code was actually written by someone at TimeGate, and by the time it came back to Gearbox, nobody even knew who had written it. And like programming languages, I don't know how familiar you are with actual programming, but basically the way the code is written is it can be very personalized. So like the way that you write code can be very different. Like if I wrote 100 lines of code, it might look very different than your 100 lines of code to do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Naming variables and functions, everything can just like, and that's why people use comments to make it clear. But anyway, if code is inherited, and especially when a project moves between two different studios multiple times, as this one did, this could have been written by some guy at TimeGate, and then when Gearbox got hold of it, they just had no idea how to read any of this stuff and didn't care enough, or like didn't have the time to go through every line of code and figure out what was what. Another possibility is that people thought the typo was intentional. There have been cases I saw on Twitter, someone was talking about how some key file in a game had the word acquire spelled incorrectly, but they couldn't change it because it was just wrapped in so many different systems and the function was just used so called upon so often that it would just be a nightmare to change it. So that's another possibility. A lot of different possibilities here. The simplest one is that just nobody noticed it and assumed that the AI bugs were from all sorts of different other problems.
It seems like the kind of thing that could happen if you have a bunch of different people on something and everyone just sort of thinks somebody else is going to fix it, or it's just no one really knows what caused it, and so it just kind of goes. And clearly the game was a mess on so many levels that maybe they're just like, I don't know who was responsible for that.
I mean, I think that's something that happens. I think it's more common than people well know is that like there's a problem in the game and nobody knows who's responsible for it, and everyone's like, oh yeah, go ask the environment people, and they're like, no, go ask the programmers, and they're like, no, go ask the systems designers, and it just gets shuffles around and nobody actually does anything on it.
I did enjoy that Gearbox posted a job listing for a programming copy editor.
Very
and,
good.
In the application, I guess it says you're supposed to put your name, your email, your phone number, and then please respond with the correct spelling of tether, which is the word that was misspelled. Yeah. And I mean, you know, funny. That's funny. Funny way.
No, that's a good way. Good way to handle it. All right, before we go, do you want to talk real quick about that Uncharted fan film that was published earlier this week? Because that was one of the more exciting things, news bits of this week, that Nathan Fillion and his crew, including a director named Alan Ungar, made this 15-minute short fan film that was Uncharted, Nathan Drake. That was just basically everything you would want from an Uncharted movie, and witty quips and funny moments, and this great camera shift where the widescreen expands and the camera goes behind the shoulder just when it's time for Nathan Drake to start shooting, like it apes you getting in control of the gameplay. Just a great film. You should go check it out if you haven't already. Did you like it?
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I mean, it wasn't like, it didn't like, you know, blow my mind or anything. It was cute. I think it meant something very different to people who like Uncharted, and I, you know, count myself as one of those people, than it would just to someone who watched it as an action movie. As a short action film, it was just like some funny quips. Nathan Fillion's very charming.
But when you watch a 2-hour movie of that?
Not of that. I would hope there would be a little more to it, but it just felt like...
Well, of course, if it was 2 hours, there would be more depth, but I'm saying you wouldn't watch a 2-hour movie with Nathan Fillion.
No,
same
of course
tone.
I would watch anything with Nathan Fillion in it.
So I actually think that would be better than any video game movie.
I think that's such a low bar that that's a meaningless statement, but you know, I would want it to just be good as a movie. But I thought it was really, really well done and really fun and entertaining. And he's great. I like the ponytail joke. It was funny. When he got in the fight with that guy, I was like, come on, he's going to grab his ponytail. This has got to,
of course.
We've got to follow up on that.
Of course.
But yeah, I mean, it was great fun and really just cool. A cool bit of synergy with an actor who clearly inspired a character. Mm-hmm. Loving that character, and clearly, like, you know, that if nothing else, that fan film showed that they truly love Uncharted. I mean, it was like, you know, the camera angle you referenced, I tweeted about that, like that was such an act of flawless recreation of, you know, a video game camera work, and just it was very clearly made by people who love those games, and Nathan Fillion obviously like loves Nathan Drake, and so it was just really cool on its own as a standalone thing. And I think the way he said that to you, yeah, sure, maybe they make a 90-minute whatever version of this, though at the same time I always try to kind of step back a little bit from like how everyone always wants more of something. Like you play a demo of something, you're like, I want the whole thing. Like you watch an episode of something, you're like, I want a whole mini series of this. You know, you watch a 15-minute fan film, it's like, I want a 90-minute version. And I understand that feeling and kind of feel that way, but also I like it as its own thing and actually would think it would be kind of cool if it just forever existed. And he was like, look, the way he said, he's like, I just wanted to make this. I just wanted I wanted to see this on a screen somewhere and for it to exist. And that's enough. I kind of like that too. I think
that's
that
a
would
good
be
point.
Fine.
Sometimes we have to be careful what we wish for. And I'm thinking of Arrested Development specifically as something where it's like, oh my God, we want more of this. And then the more you get, the worse it becomes.
I could, and considering how this was worked so well as a little self-contained thing, I could imagine 100 different ways that it could be far less good as a 90-minute version. So, you know, maybe it's good for what it is.
I guess my point is just that since Sony is and has been making an Uncharted film for 10 years now, it's been in development hell, and now I think it's going to star Tom Holland from Spider-Man. If I hope they're looking at this for tonal inspiration and just like getting an idea of what that would look like. Like if we were to get an Uncharted film, I would hope that it would be something like this. It would be in this vein.
Yeah, it would surprise me if it wasn't, only because this was so clearly in the vein of the games. And
right.
You know,
but you never
that,
know. I mean,
no, of course.
I've been hoping, like other video game movies, you would hope for so much more, but never get it.
Though other video game movies are rarely based on video games that are so clearly cinematically you know, inspired. This is such an Ouroboros that, like, Uncharted has so much cinematic language baked into what it is because it is basically a cinematic-inspired game.
It is.
That
Indiana
a movie
Jones.
Based on that kind of makes itself. I mean, it's really just, like, it's all in how you do the action sequences. Other than that, the cutscenes just kind of do another
Uncharted.
That's
true. But also, I live for those movies. Like, I love the National Treasure films inexplicably. I love Indiana Jones. So I'm totally on board for another one of those kinds of movies if it's done this well. Hopefully, it gets Sony to like just kickstart the not actually use Kickstarter but kickstart the film into production. All right, I think that is it for this week's episode. Kirk, it is good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
We got a fun summer of podcasting planned, so stick around and have fun and subscribe and leave us reviews and all that good stuff. And Drew, don't tell anybody about the entire plot that I gave away about our D&D campaign. Thanks in advance. Kirk, see you next week.
All right, see you next week, Jason. Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.